For the second year running, Croke Park has hosted a very, very special event. Around 200 people gathered for the Eid al-Adha celebration today. And to tell us all about it, I'm joined on the line by Islamic theologian and chair of the Irish Muslim Peace and Integration Council, Sheikh Dr. Umar Al-Qadri. You're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much. Good afternoon.
I've seen some of the pictures and videos of today's event at Croke Park. It looked wonderful and it looked very joyous and uplifting. But for those perhaps who aren't familiar with Eid al-Adha, can you tell us about it?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, we had today 500 people, not 200 people on the pitch. And last year we had 200. So this year the restrictions did allow us to increase that number to 500. So Eid al-Adha is a Muslim celebration, a Muslim festival. We have two Eids throughout the year. One is at the end of Ramadan to mark the ending of Ramadan. And then one is to commemorate the sacrifice of Abraham, which we also find in the Christian and the Jewish traditions. So Muslims throughout the world will come together and they will commemorate that sacrifice, but also mark the end of the fifth pillar of Islam, which is the Hajj, the pilgrimage. For us, the day starts with prayer. We all gather together in prayer. Now, obviously, because of COVID-19 restrictions, we weren't able and still aren't able to have more than 50 people in places of worship. So last year, we were allowed to have outside gathering of 200 people, and this year that number increased to 500. So we were able to have 500 people praying together in Eid, the largest Muslim gathering in Ireland. But the great thing about this Eid is, like last year, it wasn't just a celebration of our Muslim identity. For Muslims in Ireland, it was a celebration of their Irish identity as well, because we were coming together celebrating Eid on the iconic pitch of Croke Park in this historic venue. So for us, it's celebrating our dual identities, being Muslim but also being Irish at the same time.
I think that there's a very famous, was this tweet of you last year where trying your hand at hurling at Eid last year at Croke Park?
Yes, that was just a moment where I grabbed the hurling and then and somebody made a video of it and it went viral. I didn't get a chance this year to do that, but perhaps I might need to increase some training for next year.
But I think that particular little video in very, very many ways really does underscore the Irish identity of around 100,000 Muslim people living here.
That's very correct. That's right, yes. Yeah. Obviously, Croke Park is very close to every Irish person. When you know the history of Croke Park, you know about Bloody Sunday, you'll realize the importance of this venue. And the GAA has really, reflected their motto, which is where we all belong, and opened the doors to welcome, for the second time, the Muslims, which are a new addition to this Irish nation for the past many decades. Muslims started, migrating to Ireland in the 1960s, 70s. Most of them were doctors, and even today, if you go to any hospital, the majority of doctors and people working in healthcare happen to be from the Muslim faith. But then after that, many other people, migrants, made Ireland their home. And today, for them and their children, Ireland is home. Mm. And many of their children, when they go back, for example, to the country where their parents came from, they feel that they are a stranger. But in Ireland, they feel home because this is really their home.
One of the things that has been very, very hard for people of all faiths, which include an element of collective worship, is the fact that there have been very strict limits on the number of people who may worship together. But having Eid al-Adha outside in such an iconic place, as you have mentioned, really is a great symbol for the unity of faiths.
Absolutely. Congregational prayers are, in all faiths, traditions, very essential, very important. And part of that is to do because when you meet other people, you look after, you know what is happening in the society, what is happening with other families. You get a chance to look after each other, share happiness, but also sadness. And unfortunately, because of the COVID-19 restrictions, the pandemic, we didn't see that happening a lot for most of the time since this pandemic started. The places of worship in Ireland have been closed. They have been opened recently for about 3 or 4 months. And really, even then, there is a restriction of 50 people. And because of that, most mosques today had more than one service. They had 4 or 5 different services to accommodate the worshippers. But in Croke Park, we had literally 500 people being able to worship at the same time, which was really, really great and fantastic. And the broadcast on RTE News made it possible for people that weren't able to go to the mosque but still wanted to be part of the celebration to watch us live and be part of the celebration.
Well, Eid Mubarak to all Muslims across Ireland, and our thanks indeed, as always, to Sheikh Dr. Umar Al-Qadri, Islamic theologian and chair of the Irish Muslim Peace and Integration Council, for joining us and being so generous with his time. We've gotten a message into us here, 0833 97 97 97. It is for Kildare today, Larry, but I can answer your question now. So Larry has received both of his vaccinations. He has not received his COVID travel cert, and he will be going on a staycation shortly. You don't need a travel cert to travel within Ireland, so that's the first thing. And Larry says he tried to ring a specified number yesterday and was on hold for 1 hour and 43 minutes. Fair play to your patience, Larry. I might have something that could help you, though. A second EU digital COVID certificate helpline has opened today. The original one, which opened on Monday, just could not cope with the volume of calls it's receiving. This particular helpline can accept 22,000 calls in any given day. The number is 1-800-807-008, 1-800-807-008. Now, the INTO is launching its pre-budget submission, and to take us through its key pillars, I'm joined on the line by General Secretary John Boyle. John, you're very welcome to the programme.
Very much, Ciara.
I suppose one of the key thrusts of the pre-budget submission is to try to get the very overcrowded classrooms, I suppose, to fade into the past. Children here in County Kildare, many of them being taught in classrooms of in excess or 30 or more pupils, and indeed classroom crowding, overcrowding in Kildare and really surrounding counties has been problematic for many, many years. John, how would you envisage that could be eradicated?
We think it's actually going to be quite easy for the government to do it, Ciara, this particular government more than any other, because the number of pupils going to primary school in Ireland is going to drop over the next 4 years. It began to drop last September, and obviously government noticed that. We had to draw it to their attention, I suppose, and they've now decided to reduce class size by one pupil from this coming September. So, you know, there are 20% of the kids in Kildare and nationwide in supersized classes over 30, and that's symptomatic of the lack of investment that has been put into Irish primary education compared to our European neighbours. The class size average in Ireland is 24. I know some of your listeners will be surprised to hear that, but then when they hear that all over Europe the average is 20, and in some countries with way less resources than us, they'd have a class size of 15 or 16. So we're simply asking the government to keep the teachers that are already in the schools, and as the number of children drops this year, next year, the year after, it should be quite easy for them to get the class size down to 20 over the next 3 to 4 years.
And that difference, I suppose, to the uneducated ear, the difference between 24 and 30 doesn't sound that big if you were talking about purely a crowd control measure. But in an educational environment, that increases significantly the amount of time and attention that the teacher can give to each child.
Yeah, it decreases the amount of time in the bigger class. So, you know, we do try our best with the curriculum that we had the last 20 years. It's a curriculum that was designed for classes of 20 in 1999, and at that particular time, I suppose we were stuck up around 34, 35. So we have made some progress, but yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the individual attention that a child with special educational needs, a newcomer child maybe who doesn't have English or Irish as a first language, or indeed to be able to develop teams of children working so that when they eventually go into the workplace and into higher level education afterwards, that they're used to a different learning approach. And teachers, certainly if they had the smaller class sizes in the infant classes and in the disadvantaged schools, all the research done internationally proves beyond any doubt that smaller class sizes make a massive difference to the future prospects of those children in their life, long learning thereafter.
Because we are talking about primary education, John, where really the foundations and the culture of learning that a child will carry not only through their second level scholastic career, perhaps onto third level, but also into their adult life, it's particularly important that those foundations are as strong as possible.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the Education Research Centre in Drumcondra 4 years ago produced a report, and they said that the evidence indicated that smaller classes of less than 20 students in the early grades may positively impact student outcomes, and the effects can be long-term, and that the effects are greatest for children from minority and disadvantaged backgrounds. And, you know, we're just looking for government to put aside 4.8 million euro out of the budget. You know, it's a huge budget for education, but it needs to increase, and it took a pandemic for us to get certain measures in place that I could talk to you about after the class size. But obviously, if you have a country like Ireland who had to develop maps for schools a year ago, showing teachers how to pack in 30 children into a class in the middle of a pandemic, no other country had to do that. So it was a national embarrassment at the time. The Taoiseach and all the leading politicians have said how important education is going to be in the pandemic to keep schools open safely, and the safest way is to give the children a bit of space. But we're looking beyond the pandemic then, and we're looking to make sure that any children who fell behind, that they can catch up. And the best way to help them with that is to have them in a class size that's the same size as they would have in Luxembourg or Lithuania or any other European country.
Tell us, John, about those effective or de facto boons that you won during the course of the pandemic that arguably should already have been there before it began.
Well, I think that the biggest one, and it's interesting that it actually didn't cost any money at all, but we had to fight so long to get it, and that's that we would have panels of supply teachers. There is a budget for paying for substitute teachers, but most parents know and children know that every so often in the schools of Kildare, if there was a teacher out sick, the children had to go with their five or six kids into the classroom next door to be supervised for the day. So thankfully we got 115 supply panels covering two-thirds of our schools. As I say, it didn't cost any additional money because the budget was already there for it, but it just made sure that it was on a consistent basis across those 2,200 schools, that they could depend on a teacher being available in the locality to cover the absence. So we're looking for that to be extended to cover all schools from September 22. It would be at this stage. I would like to acknowledge that last week the department has stated that we're going to extend it a little bit further for this September, but obviously it's not fair to the other schools who are not availing of that scheme. The funding, you've often heard about schools doing various fundraisers, cake sales and so on. The big issue there is that we used to get €200 for every child in a primary school to cover electricity and heat and insurance and water charges. And in the recession 10 years ago, government reduced the way down to about €170. It's now at 183, and that's a very significant number because there's 183 days in a school year. So you get €1 a day per child to run your school. And we're asking that those cuts that happen be overturned and that we get back to the €200 for starters. Now, if we got that, we'd then begin to look at why a secondary school child aged 13 is worth €316, whereas a primary is only worth 183 at the moment. I mean, it's the same electricity and heat bills and insurance bills. And then the other thing, I suppose, is that our principal teachers have been really, really legendary throughout the pandemic. They had no summer off last year at all, and they need supports. And the supports that were stripped out from schools would be the middle management tier, the assistant principals. We only have, I think, just over 70% of the assistant principals that we had back in 2010. So we're looking for half of those assistant principals to be restored. So in other words, if you have a school where you're trying to coordinate special education or the green schools or the active school project, there used to be somebody coordinating that in the school, and those positions have been taken away, and I know County Kildare suffered really, really badly there. Mm. Some teachers are still continuing to do it in their own free time, but if you don't have somebody designated, coordinated, so we're really asking for government to make sure that in the small schools in Kildare, the teaching principals continue to get their one day a week release from their class. That's a win that we had last summer that has been long awaited. We want to continue that beyond 2022, and we want to make sure that a middle management system is restored to schools from beginning with this budget, with at least half of them restored in this budget and maybe the other half the year after.
Well, John Boyle, General Secretary of the INTO, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking indoor dining and the effect on children of the closure of indoor summer camps. WhatsApp in to us after my interview with Sheikh Dr. Umar Al-Qadri on 0833 97 97 97, and it says 500 Muslims can pray in an Irish sports field, yet soccer can't be played there. If we went to their country, Muslim isn't a country, we could not have a Catholic church or kneel down and say the rosary in public. On your first point, that whether or not soccer is played at Croke GAA headquarters, Croke Park, is a matter between the GAA and the Football Association of Ireland. It's nothing to do with any faith group, Muslim or otherwise. And indeed, you know, 18,000 people there to watch Kildare victorious over Westmeath just this weekend shows that the 500 people who gathered together in socially distant prayer today was really a drop in the ocean of the permissible capacity of Croke Park. But if soccer is not being played at Croke Park is a problem for you, I suggest you take that up with the GAA. Now, author, journalist and broadcaster Jen Hogan has written extensively on the impact on children's well-being of the closure to them of indoor summer camps. She has joined Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble.
So a decision was taken that indoor summer camps could not go ahead for children this year, which obviously was devastating for the businesses involved, but also for the children and parents who won't be able to avail of indoor summer camps. Now, I know, obviously, a lot of summer camps can still happen outside, the likes of sports camps and other camps are able to move outdoors, but there are some which really need to be indoors, and particularly hard to imagine rain when we're in the middle of this glorious weather. But, you know, this is Ireland. Our climate is unpredictable and some things just can't work outside. And I know myself from last year, now my children were very lucky this year. They've done their summer camp. It was outdoors. They were able to do it. We don't have any others planned for this year. But last year when they were doing their summer camp, we had horrific weather, absolutely awful weather. And twice during the course of the summer camp, I was called to come and collect the kids because they just couldn't go ahead. And I suppose that's what my frustration really with this and other parents' frustration from those I was speaking to is really that once again, the need and the well-being of children is kind of dismissed, I suppose, really. You know, they've had a tough pandemic. Times have been really, really hard for them. So much that they've been looking forward to has been cancelled. The school closures obviously had a huge and dramatic impact and effect, and we're only going to see the real and true effect of that over the course of the coming months. Children with additional needs who were disproportionately affected through the school closures are kind of dependent on these camps to help them, to give them that opportunity to catch up. Some of the camps in particular, which are aimed at those things like occupational therapy camps, I've had parents there get in contact to say their child is devastated because that has been cancelled. But not only are they devastated and disappointed, this opportunity to catch up is gone. It's taken away from them. So I suppose, and then when we take it back to parents as well and actually look at the reality of parents, you know, parents had to take quite a lot of time off earlier this year and during the first school closures to try to cope with homeschooling and juggling all the different demands of life, you know, in the middle of a lockdown. A lot of parental leave that perhaps would have been saved for the summer has been used at this stage. You know, in fairness, it's a really, really difficult situation, and most parents would rely on summer camps to help make up some of their childcare solutions. So it's left people in a really difficult position.
Well, Jen, if we just go back over the fact that, you know, fun for children, it has been, as you mentioned in your article in the Irish Times today, it's been stripped from kids' lives at various points over the past 18 months. And have you found with your own children or with people who get in contact with you, have they been noting that their children are suffering and having a difficult time.
Yeah, I mean, going back to school was obviously great for children. You know, it was well needed. But obviously school looks very different in pandemic times. There are restrictions, there are bubbles, there are rules, a lot more rules that have to be followed. And these camps, a lot of parents would absolutely flag how vital they were for children's social skills and for just having the crack, because we seem to have forgotten how important it is for children to just have the crack and have a bit of fun. Like, childhood should be free and it should be filled with fun times, you know, and instead it's been 17 months of restrictions and worries and washing of hands and bubbles. And of course, like, bubbles are something that we'll have to, you know, still factor in summer camps, but they can happen in a fun way. It was that whole idea of giving children back some fun again and letting there be some kind of normality in their lives and not cancelling yet again their plans, because so many of their plans have been cancelled, so many rites of passage haven't happened, so many milestones have been missed, that it is really important. And I don't think it's fair how easily children's needs and basic needs such as to have fun are dismissed, you know, as a, well, we got to suck it up, because that seems to have been the motto of the thing, and the bar seems to be set very, very low. As long as you're alive, you know that's what we're aiming for. Well, children need to have fun too, and we need to recognise that, and we will see the consequences of that. Parents have said to me that how anxious their children are becoming, how slow they were to re-engage with activities that they loved before, even things like the sports, which could happen outdoors. So that is very visible for many parents, and it's why another reason why these camps are so important.
Say parents out there, their children are not at the indoor summer camps over the past couple of weeks and won't be in the future couple of weeks left of the holidays. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have to them to keep their kids occupied, having fun, educational to some capacity, and also maybe in terms of having some sort of childcare availability? Can that be sorted out during these months?
You see, that is actually, I think this is where we're in a really difficult position, because you'll have lots of people referring to the good old days where children played out the front and had fun with their friends out the front, and this was how summers went. And I was one of those children who played out the front, but then I was also one of those children who had a parent at home who was able to supervise me and my sisters and make sure we were safe while we went outside and played out the front all day. And all the children on my road were the same. There was a parent, typically mum, at home, and so those things were a little bit easier. I mean, I know my own kids love nothing more than to get out and play out the front with their pals, but their pals aren't always available, even if they are, because their pals are sometimes in other camps or in other childcare scenarios, because the realities of 2021 is that most families will have working parents at home, and not everybody is able to facilitate the supervision that's required at home. And I don't mean standing outside looking over them, but actually being at home and making sure there's somebody there to see, to tend to that cut knee, or keep an overall eye on what's going on. So that it is going to be a huge problem, and certainly what I have heard from anecdotally from parents is that, I suppose, shared play dates are kind of combating some of the issues. You know, they'll come to me today and then they'll go to you the next day, and this is, I suppose, they're having to find innovative ways, which again brings its own concerns around the pandemic and how that might happen. But when we have lovely weather like this, you're able to have children outside. It is going to be yet another tough summer, like it was a tough time during the pandemic restrictions for parents who are working to try to work around childcare arrangements. But look, once we have the glorious weather, if there's a parent at home who can supervise at all, kids can make their own fun, in fairness.
Now, again, in the article from today's Irish Times, Jen, you did note that in general, and it is a generalisation, but in terms of percentages, it is true, women are picking up the slack. Mm. And it has been a difficult 18 months for women.
It has. Look, I mean, if you even look, we were one of the only schools, countries in Europe where schools didn't open for the children of frontline workers. So when you think about that, that the proportion of our frontline workers who are female, they were just left then with the childcare solution to try to work out, because the schools weren't open for them to go to school. It just showed a total lack of consideration for women, because it was women. The statistics, the figures show that during the period of homeschooling, it was mostly mothers who engaged in the schoolwork and the homeschooling at home. It has been mostly mothers who opted to take parental leave or holidays or other types of leave so that they could cover those periods of closure. It has been mostly mothers who are trying to deal with the fallouts of access to supports and therapies closed and dealing with all the different consequences for children, because while they're absolutely fantastic, and that's not to take credit from dad, this is actually shown in the statistics, in the figures, that it is women who do most of the childcare, who do most of the work at home in same-sex couples, and it is, or sorry, in different-sex couples, and it is mostly women who do most of that work, and the same has continued throughout the pandemic, and it has been women who have felt the slack. And there are lots of people saying this will set women back a generation. They had to take that step back away from their career. They had to take that step back away from just keeping things ticking over, and had very little time to look after themselves even, because there was just such huge, unbearable demands put on families and on women as they tried to keep things going.
Well, Jen, no doubt when all is said and done, and would say in the next 2 or 3 years we're looking back on the past 18 months, we'll have a lot more answers to our questions. Jen Hogan, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
And that was Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. Now, government officials and stakeholders from the hospitality sector will meet this evening to discuss the practicalities of the resumption of indoor dining. One of those stakeholders is the Restaurants Association of Ireland. I'm joined on the line now by its vice president, Paul Lennon. He's owner and operator of Hearts of Kildare, also Firecastle Lane in Kildare Town, the Dewdrop Inn and the Brewhouse in Kill, and Ashton's in Clonskee. Paul, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Likewise, I know that your colleague Adrian Cummins has been saying today that he expects time limits for indoor dining to be scrapped. We expect also that indoor dining will resume next Monday. Do you feel that the protocols, insofar as we know them now, are sufficiently robust for your members and also your customers?
I do, and I think, yes, absolutely. Look, it's something we've been obviously working alongside the government for the last couple of months through negotiations with various bodies to make the place as safe as possible. And obviously it's kind of following the same protocols that was there before. But we will do whatever we can to make sure it's safe, and we'll follow the guidelines to the best of our abilities.
And is there enough of a lead-in for your members? Because I know that most food, fresh food, certainly has a short shelf life. Are wholesalers going to face a run of orders this time tomorrow?
I think they are. And that's still all based on the fact that we do get the go-ahead. We're expecting it. But, we've been in this situation before, and we've been closed down, and we've been put on a week. So I think at this stage, a lot of our members are holding fire. It's a lot easier to pick up the phone on Thursday morning and for us to make an order. Unfortunately, where it's hard is for the wholesalers and is for our producers, our providers. They could be in for an exceptionally busy few days. We wouldn't be ordering anything before kind of Thursday, Friday anyway. But at the same time, it's very unfair for them, even at this stage, to not get confirmation 4 days out is difficult enough. So look, it's certainly not going to be easy for them.
And I mean, we're speaking almost as if it's a done deal, Paul, but there's many a slip, as you well know, betwixt cup and lip. So you could have a very positive meeting tonight, yourself, government officials and other key stakeholders in the hospitality sector. You could go to Cabinet tomorrow afternoon and find that it's about turn, or there's change in key elements. I suppose the two key elements for your members are probably time limits on indoor dining, and as Adrian Cummins was suggesting earlier, he feels they're going to be scrapped. I'm sure your members would welcome that. What though about policing vaccination?
Well, that is the big ticket question, I suppose, at the moment. How is it going to be policed? And again, we haven't got any confirmation on how that's going to happen either. So we are waiting with bated breath to figure that out. So we can inform our staff and we can put new procedures into place. But it is going to be an extremely volatile few days. Even if they do give us the go-ahead, trying to factor in a whole new checking system for people with the vaccine or not is going to make things very, very difficult on our staff. And another layer that I suppose they have to deal with everything else that's been going on. But look, again, if it means us getting it open, we'll certainly do what we can. At this stage, it's about just getting our business back open and getting us back indoors.
I say this advisedly, if it was just an administrative burden on your staff and members, Paul, I think some system could be found to get around it. But in hospitality, there are people. and people have been known to get very tetchy, and customers assume that they're always right. And I feel, and I would imagine that you already know, that many staff members are going to be faced with really aggressive commentary from some people who may elect not to abide by whatever regulations we see this time tomorrow.
I think that's a given. I think that's something we're going to have to be ready to accept. It's not going to be easy. It's going to put a huge burden on senior management staff as well. Then we're going to have to jump in to kind of diffuse the situation. But it is going to happen. There's no doubt about it. You know, we're already getting flack on our social media platforms about even the thoughts and considerations of us having to admit to this and actually to have to turn away people. Which I agree, you know, is not fair in principle, but if it's a case, if this is the time we're in, if it allows us to get open, it's just something we're going to have to do, and everybody's just going to have to accept it.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say I would imagine, Paul, that a lot of people that are giving restaurants, etc., flack on social media for having to administer this, we don't yet know what form, are also in the same cohort of people who have booked and just not shown up for outdoor dining.
Well, there you said it. Look, there is a huge amount of this. And if we all had big enough spaces outside the front of the premises, we probably wouldn't even be having the conversations we're having. We'd be happy to stay the way we are for the summer. But the fact is, there's too many businesses that rely on indoor business and just can't do the outdoor. We have three premises, as you mentioned there. One of them is a super outdoor area in Dublin. It's busier than ever was. Then we've a place in Kill that is on 50-50. And in Kildare, where we're still shut for outdoor because we just don't have the space. So we know we need to get open in Kildare. We need to get something going. Our staff need to be back to work. We need to get a name back out there, and the same in the Dewdrop. You know, so it's just not. None of this is making it easy for us at all. But look, again, we're just stuck in this situation where we just need to get open. We just need to something. We need positivity, and we need to get going.
And not to be a positive, but even when you do get open, social distancing, etc., means that the number of covers that you will be able to do in any given premises on any given evening, even if the time limits on indoor dining are lifted, may mean that it's not this financial sigh of relief that you're going to experience. It's more, we can just about keep our heads above water now.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, the time limits will obviously affect some people. If some restaurants will decide to keep time limits just purely so they can turn over tables because they have limited space. And that would have gone on a regular. People forget that we used to do that anyway pre-COVID. We were given a two-hour setting, right around 5 in at 7 in at 9. And that was a stat. It was a done thing anyway. So
it's just we didn't refer to them. The general public didn't refer to them as a time limit on dining,
exactly,
but was
exactly.
It a de facto limit?
It was there. We always administered it anyway. So, you know, there is always time that if you could, I suppose it was having that flexibility to give that table that extra half hour, that extra 45 minutes. But obviously with the guidelines, that might be taken away. It looks like it could be. But we would still have to kind of administer that, certainly in Hearts, because we're limited. We only had a certain amount of space pre-COVID. The knocking it down is certainly knocked it down by about 40%. So we will still operate a time limit because just to get people through and just to make sure everybody gets served and gets happy.
Well, hopefully, Paul, this time tomorrow you'll have some certainty on the manner and form of the opening and the precise date. That's Paul Lenehan. He's Vice President of the Restaurants Association of Ireland, also owner and operator of Hearts here in Kildare, Firecastle Lane, Kildare Town, the Dewdrop Inn and the Brew House. Now, there is a small risk that some fully vaccinated people will get infected with COVID-19. It's known as breakthrough infection, and it could pose a risk, particularly to older people. Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble has been speaking on this matter to the founder of the Independent Scientific Advisory Group, Professor Anthony Staines, who's also a Professor of Health Systems at DCU.
Yesterday we heard from Philip Nolan of NPHET saying that a wave of infection in young people or younger people will break through vaccine protection in vulnerable groups. What says you?
I think, unfortunately, that Philip is right about this. The mathematics are fairly straightforward. Vaccines are very effective, but they do not give 100% protection. As a result of that, as cases rise, as risk rises in the general population, the risk of getting infected amongst vulnerable people and amongst older people also rises. Now, the risk is much lower. The risk of a bad outcome is much lower than it was before they were vaccinated, but it's still much higher than one would like. So the indications from Israel and the UK are that the number of people admitted to hospital who are seriously ill with COVID-19 is rising, and many of these people are older vaccinated people or otherwise vulnerable vaccinated people. And unfortunately, the number of deaths in that group is beginning to rise as well. And that is not what we want to see here.
Anthony, take myself as example. I'm in my 20s. I am fully vaccinated. Should I be ensuring that I'm still following all the same rules, I guess, and guidelines that I did pre-vaccination to what has been now, would say, 2 months post-vaccination?
Unfortunately, yes. Until we bring the case numbers under control, which is going to take quite some time, we are all at risk. Now, there is a disturbing analysis from a very respected colleague in the UK who's arguing that to stop the spread of virus with vaccination alone, we need over 98% vaccination coverage. Now, I don't know if that's right, but the person in question is well regarded. But there's no doubt in the minds of anyone in public health that it's going to take quite some time for vaccination on its own to have a major impact. We've argued that the government needs to take action now to reduce case numbers, and we've argued it for quite a long time. And to give us an alternative to continuing lockdowns for another 6 months, which nobody wants.
Okay, so you mentioned obviously decreasing the case numbers, which for the past few days have been over 1,000 every single day. But to do so, Anthony, what is the answer to that if it's not a lockdown?
The answer to that is to upgrade local public health resources. Many countries in the same situation have recruited many hundreds of people, often people with a customer service background, to support local public health in contact tracing, case finding. We still don't know in Ireland where most people get infected. We need to know that. And to support people who need to be isolated. We need bodies to do that. Public health is set up to manage 30 or 40 cases of whatever you're having yourself a day, not 1,000 cases a day. We haven't enough bodies to do that. So most countries have done this well, have just recruited a herd of people, given them brief training, and sent them out under the management of public health experts.
And why is the government not doing this here in this country?
Well, it's a really good question, and I don't know the answer.
When the ISAG poses that question, there is no answer currently?
There's no answer that I've heard currently. We have suggested it repeatedly since last April. That's April 2020. But it hasn't been taken up.
Right,
and
so if you were...
We don't know why.
If you were a betting man, you would say, unfortunately, it seems as if the only answer to this is there will be further lockdowns, because as we look over across the water in Britain and we know the virus really is running rampant over there, there's talks of over 200,000 cases a day over in Britain. And England in particular, they were due their Freedom Day yesterday, which didn't turn out the way that, you know, the Prime Minister had promised. Yeah. If they are worrying and speaking about, just as Freedom Day came, the 19th of July, more lockdowns, then are Irish people looking at the same fate?
Well, we are if the government chooses to go down that road. There are alternatives. WHO said in March 2020, quite correctly, that lockdowns were not a control mechanism for an infection. What lockdowns do is they buy you time. So case numbers are soaring, you're not entirely sure what's going on, you close everything down, and then you bring in the public health measures, and you bring it under control. This is routine for epidemics in all parts of the world. This is normal standard practice. But what you don't do is you don't continue the lockdown as the main control measure for months and months, and in our case, now, what, nearly 18 months of lockdowns since March of last year?
Yes.
At colossal cost to the economy, to jobs, to people's lives, to schools, to mental health. That's not the, for our money at least, that is not the way to go.
Anthony, look, there's so many questions anytime we discuss something like this, and no doubt lots of people listening in do have many questions. But I do want to mention something that we spoke about earlier on Kildare Today, about the fact that close contacts, they will not be offered PCR testing, which is analysed in a lab, the gold standard of testing, I guess you could call it, if community testing demand exceeds 20,000 today. Now, we know with this current variant, Delta, it is much more contagious than variants of concern in the past. In all likelihood, we will probably exceed testing of 20,000 a day, especially as the country reopens more and more, and indoor dining looks set to reopen in the coming weeks, if we go by what we're hearing at the moment with the meetings of government and the industry groups. What will that mean if people are at home doing their own DIY antigen testing? As a member of Irish Scientific Advisory Group, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's outrageous. I think it's grossly unfair to people. And I think people have a right to expect proper levels of contact tracing, proper levels of testing. Now, we had a dress rehearsal for this at Christmas, and we failed. Tony Holland stood up and said that they were effectively, because they were overwhelmed, they're going to stop contact tracing, they're going to stop testing close contacts.
Now, Anthony, can I just stop you there for 1 second? Because people listening, the first thing they'll say to the radio is, but the situation was different at Christmas. Not even our frontline healthcare workers and vulnerable groups had been vaccinated. Now we have, I think it's 2.4 million people are doubly vaccinated, to have their two doses, or fully vaccinated, I should say, as some people may have just had one dose with Janssen. And 2.6 million, or 2.8 million, I believe, have received one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Does that not make a difference?
Well, it should, yes. And we should be able to cope with whatever this throws at us. We should have learned our lessons from December. And if we haven't learned our lessons from December, we need to ask very pointed questions as to why we haven't learned our lessons from December. Because, you know, this is basic public health. If we're not doing it, there had better be a very, very good reason.
Professor Anthony Staines, Professor of Public Health at DCU, as always, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Mind yourself. Bye-bye.